Introducing Rav Moshe Aberman at 9-ish on a Thursday morning as we continue to zip along with Zoom with the Farag Shkolo. Rav Aberman will continue with the Achronim and their Torah Shabbat literature. Thanks,
Very good.
Tomer, for away.
You got it correct this time, Bruce. Okay.
I've been on the money the last few weeks.
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, good morning to everyone. As Bruce mentioned, we're continuing with the discussion on the Achronic period. Basically, this week's shiur and Mitzvah Hashem next week's shiur will more or less close the topic. The discussion we will focus on today is primarily the learning or the commentaries on Gemara, the forms of learning Gemara and the commentaries on Gemara, where if I were to either get into depth about the different commentaries or try to even cover all of the different things that were written during the Achronic period, we would need a long series of discussions in of itself, and I don't think that that's what we're here for.
It's important
What we will
for us to
try.
hear the styles of what actually, meaning if you walked into a yeshiva today, can you always tell if there's a difference in style or?
Not today. And again, there are all kind of categorizations, but in reality, that doesn't always work. You can have in one yeshiva different people teaching in different styles. Usually within a certain general thematic approach, but different styles. Maybe we'll discuss it at some point, just to give some examples of it. But no, I don't think you can truly and fairly categorize. And that doesn't mean that yeshivot don't present themselves in a certain way. It doesn't mean that in the public image, certain yeshivot today and in the past didn't have some kind of view or perception. But in many cases, there were deviations, whether students who were in yeshiva but did things a little differently, whether rabbeim, and I'll speak at least in one case of that, rabbeim, who differed in their approach than the founding Yeshiva, Yeshiva, and so on. That
And I
exists
know
today.
my Daf Yomi Chavruta has, I think, a master's or a PhD from Hebrew U in Talmud. He told me that the professors were very fun people. But I imagine there's something different about the learning there that might have been going on in the yeshiva. If you could tell us
In
what
the
that difference
academic
might
world, for
be.
sure. The academic learning is completely different than the learning in yeshivot. The intent, the purpose, and the focus, accordingly, is different. You mentioned that in Hebrew University, most of the leading Torah personalities who were giving the lectures were Orthodox. But even there, in knowing some of them personally, literally, personally, having worked with them, there is a range of where they stand today. And
You studied
they
Talmud
differ
in
also
university?
academically. They differ academically, they differ religiously. And most of them also learned Yeshiva.
You also
So
learn academically?
most of the academics today, leading academics today in Talmud, had learned for at least a period of time in Yeshiva.
No, I'm asking if you yourself actually learned academically.
No, I didn't learn, I didn't, I never learned academically, but I know some of these people through contact, and at least some of them literally were my age learning with me in yeshiva. So yeah, as I said, that's, I can tell you they're different, and I can tell you that they have a background in yeshiva. If you take, I'll just take two examples of people. Not necessarily, one of them is not necessarily directly in Talmud, but they chances are, if you're learning Talmud and Jewish studies, you encounter him. So one, if I take, for example, Professor Moshe Halbertal and Professor Simcha Emanuel, you're talking about two people whose approaches are different academically. Their religious places and their thinking is different. And they were always different. So, you know, that doesn't... But in any case, the academic world, what it's looking for and its point of reference is different. I think that on a personal level, I think that there is what to get from the academic world as far as perceptions, as far as certain tools. But I don't think that the approach that some people take, that they're so legitimate versus the yeshiva world, that I don't think is correct. I think that there's simply two approaches, two sets of goals, and therefore it's different. But then again, as I said, the academic world, you will find differences in Talmud or Jewish studies departments in different universities, as well as you find different approaches in yeshivot. And I'm not just talking about a broad distinction between, you know, yeshivot hesder and the more Haredi, or what they call, what they like to call the old world yeshivot, Lam Yeshivot Yashan, or what kind of other names they give themselves. Those approaches exist, but even within each of those groups, individuals have significant differences in how they approach and what they believe in. And that was true also for hundreds of years. And that's a little bit what we will find here. So previously, in last week's shiur, I mentioned two approaches that were prevalent during the Achronic period. And definitely, let's say, the first half of the Achronic period. That is the Pilpul approach. Approach that creates analysis, distinctions by taking different sources in the Gemara and tries to come up with sharp, exciting distinctions that give an understanding of the issue being discussed. But the Pilpul approach, and definitely the Pilpul approach as it progressed. In other words, as I said last week, it may stem from the Balei HaTosfot, but it's very different than the approach of the Balei HaTosfot. As it progressed, became less and less halachically focused, and basically created almost a schism between the analytical discussion of a sugya and Gemara versus the halachic ruling that might come about and sometimes draws from that same sugya. And that was one approach that we spoke about a little bit last week. The opposite approach was the more bekeilut, usually leaning towards a halachic focus in the learning. I say usually because it wasn't all necessarily there, and definitely in later periods.
Would you say there's a goal to understand a halacha, or is it more to improve one's, I'm not sure, midot, knowledge base, connection to God? I mean, is there a certain purpose like that, as opposed to just gaining some knowledge on what the text says?
It's not a question of knowledge of what the text is, but the application of the text to our lives and how we are to live our lives. Now, as a whole, there was always an awareness that included in the Talmudic database is material, some halachic, some agadic, that has both halachic significance in guiding us in how to deal with situations from a halachic point of view, what would be the correct behavioral aspect on a pragmatic halachic perspective, and also a moral message, a development of a personality, a moral, even philosophical, not in a pure aspect of philosophy, but philosophical in the sense of a perspective of life, a philosophical personality.
So this has nothing to do with Nefesh V'Chaim.
Don't jump.
Okay. Hey,
now, I think that that was always there, and I think that every Torah scholar throughout the ages has that in mind on one level or another. The question is, in their writing, in the shurim that they give, where the focus and where the stress is. And here you find different approaches and different value systems and different stresses. And it's legitimate and it's understandable. Sometimes the circumstances of time, sometimes it's an approach that divides and comes and says, you know what, the halachic reality I'll learn through learning Shviyot and Gemara and then the post-game and see it as they develop. And the moral aspect I'll learn through learning books of Musar, that even though they themselves draw their value system from the Gemara, but they're much more clear and much more to the point, and it becomes much more difficult to directly extract it from the Gemara. And others might come and say, I don't need the Musar book. I can extract it directly from the Gemara. That value system is reflected. Chazal's value system is reflected in the Gemara. And if I learn the Gemara seriously, I will also absorb the value systems and not just the data knowledge.
Would you put the Tanakh in that category as well?
What's that?
Some of my friends told me they've never learned Tanakh except through Gemara. And one doesn't need to learn Tanakh except through the Gemara.
No, I think that is something that developed in certain stages in the Achronic period. On a personal level, I think that's not correct. And I think it was, let's put it this way, all Chachmei Yisrael wrote on Tanakh, expressed that reservation. Now, you can come and say, oh, and all those who didn't, obviously, didn't think so. I don't know. I can't tell you. But clearly, you're talking about, you know, major personalities that get focused. Let's also say that...
I'm
going to go back to my main point. Let's also say that...
No, Avi had a question for you.
Avi, one second. Let's also say that most of the Torah scholars also have and had a knowledge and familiarity of Tanakh. And those who don't are usually the lesser knowledgeable in Torah in general. Yes, Avi?
I said, if they teach that all in yeshivot, they certainly de-emphasize it. They don't teach it, certainly not the way people that we go to classes of Tanakh teach it today. Certainly not, you know.
You're correct. You're correct. And it wasn't only today. It was something that became very common, definitely in the Achronic period. I don't know to tell you exactly in the Rishonic period. And that's what I mentioned in one of the previous classes when we talked about Parshanut Tanakh, the uniqueness of what the Netziv did in Balazin, that he had a regular shiur in Chumash, which then developed into his Pirush. Yes, it's not a common thing, but let's remember that in many yeshivot, also learning what today is found in certain places, learning systematically halachic areas of Yoredeya and Arachayim from Tesnicha was also done on the side. There was a distinction in many Torah institutions between the study of things that are being taught primarily around Gemara and the enrichment that came primarily independently through reading and learning these sources. For good or bad, and I'm not assessing that. Okay, so let's get back to our main point, and that is the issue of the styles of learning Gemara in the Aharonic period. The Pilpul, and on the other hand, the Bekiut. The Bekiut approach came and said that to basically understand or be able to deal with things, you have to have a familiarity, an exposure to a broad range of the sources. And therefore, if you learn three, four masechtot, you're lacking in a true understanding of what Chazal is saying, and consequently, also in its application, halacha. There's a lot of truth to that. I don't think that anybody would deny it. There was also a feeling that the Pilpul approach was putting in a lot of time and effort into something that didn't really contribute to the knowledge and the absorption of Torah values. It gave, at best, a certain development of analytical skills that could be used also in other areas. Those were the two primary approaches in the earlier periods of the Aharonic period. Later periods of the Aharonic period, we have, in the second half, we have a slightly different approach. In other words, one that does not necessarily feel that the Bekiut approach is sufficient. Now again, when I said Bekiut, it doesn't mean just reading the Gemara. Bekiut meant usually learning the Rashi and the familiarity and Tosfot, sometimes other Rishonim here and there. But it wasn't meant to sit and delve into the analysis of the text that I was reading and the things that I was reading. More familiarity to know what was said and then apply it in a halachic way. The approach that came around later was a more analytical approach that developed, interestingly, in Lithuania. Okay? The what's called Yeshivot Mita. Okay? The Yeshivot that developed in Lithuania, where they were really seen as the royalty, the knowledgeable Torah people. And in other areas of Europe, much of the other approaches still remain for much longer. And only today, I would say that that approach of analytical learning has dominated. For example, in Europe, the classic, with exceptions, the classic Hasidic learning was a very, very peculiar kind of approach. Because of the Hasidic spirit of everybody and so on. Today, many Hasidic yeshivot have a lot more of an analytical approach that has absorbed from, for different reasons, from other places. Similarly, the Sephardi world, with the exceptions of maybe certain places, the Sephardi yeshivot today are much more analytical. But again, that's a function that some of their Rashi Yeshiva grew and developed in Ashkenazic places. But in any event,
analytical means conclusion-based or halachic-based, or what do you mean by analytical?
Analytical as far as taking the text, taking the issue that's being discussed and analyzing it and trying to understand different aspects of it. Maybe the star or the leading approach in that analytical learning is the Brisk approach. I say the star because there are, even before the Reb Chaim Soloveitchik develops the risk approach, there is already systematic analytical learning and writing that is meant to truly understand what it is that the Gemara is trying to convey to us, how the, sometimes it's a question of phraseology that's used, sometimes it's an issue of comparing different sources and understanding why they're different. Sometimes it's a question of understanding how different Mishonim, for example, may have seen or read this Gemara and why they understood it differently. That's all part of the analytical approach.
Does that mean they always learn with Rishonim and using an analytical approach where they call into other commentaries on it?
Yes, the more analytical approach one would take, then the exposure or the use of at least several other Rishonim was called for. Now, that doesn't mean that it required this broad knowledge of Rishonim. In certain cases, first of all, as far as not all Torah scholars had available to them as broad a range of books of Rishonim as we have today. Secondly, if you want to understand an approach, obviously there's going to be differences on a particular point or here at a particular point there. But if you take the Ramban, the Rashban, the Ritva, for example, you've got a line that in majority of places gives you a similar kind of perception of the Gemara, because it's made in rough. And therefore, even if you're familiar with one of them, it gives you an ability to analyze that kind of an approach. Just deviating a little bit from the specifics of it, but to help understand this, there's no question in my mind, okay, if we were to take two personalities in recent times and compare them, Soloveitchik versus Rav Ovadia Yosef, and I'm taking purposely those two, I have no question in my mind that the knowledge base, in other words, the familiarity with a range of books that Rav Ovadia Yosef had, Rav Soloveitchik did not have. On the other hand, the ability to take a topic, analyze it, reach its core, and then use it accordingly, Rav Soloveitchik was so superior to anything that Rav Ovadia Yosef would ever be able to do that you couldn't even compare. So what we see here is that there is a tension between the exposure to a broad base of information versus the actual analysis and creation of svarot or rationalities in the The difference in the perspective that I presented is because they come from two different extreme schools of thought or the study. Rav Ovadia Yosef comes from the Kiyut Halachic approach, and Rav Soloveitchik is a descendant of the Soloveitchik line and basically is a Brisker par excellence. But the Brisk approach took the analytical approach to almost extremes, but on the other hand, gave it a certain strength that even though afterwards it sort of inseminates and becomes lesser in the use in further generations, but it gives it its power and its ability. As Rav Soloveitchik writes in his Hesped to his uncle, Madodech Midot. He speaks about the precepts of the brisk approach. What are the basis of the brisk approach? And amongst the things that he speaks about and that he mentions there is the idea that you develop a terminology that accompanies you and follows through in learning in any area. Okay. Just take one example. Okay. The term tzvei, it's used in Yiddish, tzvei dini. Dini. What we have before us are two separate halachot. And when you seem to think that there's a problem, contradiction, it's not really a contradiction, because this is talking about one aspect and this is talking about a different aspect. And it's tzvei dinim, as the brisk approach to show, is something that is embedded all the way down to the Gemara. The terminology that people may be more familiar with, cheftza and gavra, is this applied to the object itself or to the person who has to do something? The cheftza and the gavra. Okay? These are things that are part of the terminology developed in the brisk approach. An approach that, as Rav Soloveitchik, in his purest presentation of it, says it's basically an approach that comes to create construct. Understand the construct, the relationship and the building of all the halachic information and the halachic world. He very strongly, both because of his background and his thinking at the time, compares it to the philosophy of mathematics. And it tries to create a systematic order. I'll relate, for example, to one thing that he mentions there. And I see it to some extent in personal perspective these days, because I'm learning right now the Mishnayot Masechet Kelim. What Rav Soloveitchik speaks about is that brisk approach, a Masechet like Masechet Kelim, a list of utensils, most of which we are not even familiar with today, or our machines and utensils are greatly different than what is there, into an approach that basically looks for the principles that are found there. And I have to say, when I've been learning Masechet Kelim, I've, in my mind, because of my familiarity with that, have been playing with that distinction. What parts of the Mishnah is just a question of this Kli and that Kli and that Kli, but you find a principle that follows through an entire Mishnah, sometimes an entire Perek. And its application to particular tenses.
So how does this differ from what you learned at Har Etzion, for example?
Well, the Har Etzion approach of learning is, I'm not going to get into it right now. Maybe when we get to the discussion in our time, where it might differ, maybe I'll touch it later. But where it differs a little, but fundamentally, it is an analytical yeshiva that definitely drew a lot of its learning from through Rav Lichtenstein and direct, therefore, through Rav Soloveitchik from the brisk approach. So, yes, my thinking is very much affected, even though I would not call myself of almost choice. I'm not the classic Bruce, but I'm definitely affected in my approach, my thinking, and my reading from the Bruce thinking.
And there are several Bruce machines, so do they all differ?
And that's exactly it. When I am looking at Masechet Kelim, I'm aware of the kelim, but I'm also asking myself, I almost like ran through my head, maybe I should write once a booklet or a book of klalei kelim, the principles that rule Masechet Kelim. I think it's something that would be interesting to put together. But yeah, here, so the brisk approach came to create a sharp, analytical, systematic approach that is used and gives a deep understanding of different issues throughout Shas. Yes,
well, there are different brisk yeshivas, and are they all essentially very similar?
Okay, so that in light of Bruce's question, I will take 2 minutes to discuss that. The answer is yes or no. In other words, similar without any question. When I have to first of all reserve the similarity, similar to the technical learning approach and analysis of Gemara and halachic sources. I would not say that they're all the same as far as hashkafic perspectives and therefore the sort of putting together of that analysis, that brisk analysis with hashkafic world. There you'll find major differences. The brisk approach begins with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, even though in many places his father, Yoshe Be'er Soloveitchik, is listed as the father of the first of Bris, but the Yoshe Be'er Soloveitchik's approach was more of a pupil kind of learning, and in one of his articles, Soloveitchik really speaks about the discussion between Rav Chaim and his father, where Rabbi Yoshe Be'er sort of is the one who says to Rav Chaim, you know, you're creating a problem, because he says, when I have an approach, so a person asks me a question, and I give him an answer, and he's happy because when I give him the answer, he feels that his question was some wow question, and it brought about this beautiful answer, and I'm happy I gave him the answer, and so on. When you are asked the question, and you answer it, the guy feels like he's still an idiot, because after you answered it, it's so obvious, why did you ask the question? Okay, but that's exactly the difference between a pupil and analytical approach. So therefore, the real founding personality is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik developed this approach when he was in Volozhin. Now, I noted before that there can be a situation where a yeshiva learns in a certain way and a particular personality comes and does different. That happened in Volozhin. Learned basically on a more bekiut approach. That was the approach of Rav Chaim Mivolozhin. That was the strength, even though he brought in a tremendous amount of depth with him, but that was the strength of the Nasir, the bekiut side. He just brought in a range of things that nobody else used, Drashei Halacha and so on. Came Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. He created this analytical approach. The analytical approach, just the effort and time that was needed for it, did not allow to keep the pace of learning that was common in Volozhin. It was a pace of learning that was based more or less on a Daf Gemara day. Through about 7 years, you would cover the entire Shas, and they learned. That's how they learned. They learned the entire Shas. Because they have a person who came in at a certain point in their learning and left 3-4 years later and never learned any Masechta in Nezik. But I am therefore in Volozhin. The approach is different. Started developing his approach, this analytical approach. Rav Chaim Bris, later when he was after, towards the closing of the Volozhin Yeshiva, he left earlier, and he ended up in the town of Brisk. There he set up his own yeshiva. And he drew very, very intelligent talmidim who continued his approach. One of the interesting things that besides the things that I mentioned before, one of the interesting things that the Chaim introduces is the centrality of the Rambam. The Rambam becomes a focal point. And the Rambam becomes not just a Sefer Halacha, but the Rambam's Halacha becomes a commentary to the Sugya.
It wasn't so accepted till now, the Rambam, or wasn't?
The Rambam was accepted. The Rambam was accepted. Initially, in certain places, it was the halachic book. At times, things changed and so on. The Rambam was always recognized as an important source in the halachic assessment. But it was viewed, what I'm saying is putting it in extremes for the purpose of discussion. It wasn't always that. But the Rambam as a whole, safer halacha. And it was a source ruling and knowledge. It wasn't something that was read as a commentary to the Sugya in the Gemara. And this is something that begins with the Brisk, with the Chaim Brisk and the Brisker approach, and has become very, very popular, very much of the way of learning. Some yeshivot more, some less. If you go to Shivat today, Yeshivat Maved Amin, Berkat Moshe, the Rambam is Kodesh Kodashim. Right, because that was mostly because that was Rabinovitz's Zichrono Livracha focus, but this already begins, or this is something that the Brisk approach brings forward. Yes, Bruce.
Yeah, you were commenting on the brightness of some of the students.
Right.
So I'm curious if you walked into yeshivas, whether it's a Musa yeshiva, a Hasidic yeshiva, a Lajin yeshiva. In Lublin, for example, when I was there, they said, there was a test given. You had to memorize something like 200 pages about Pat, and they can ask you whatever they want. If you pass that test, you're accepted. So I'm just curious, what type of students went to what type of yeshiva, and was it open? We have this idea that back in Elazar ben Azariah's day, they opened the gates to yeshiva, as opposed to Rabbi Gamliel, who had a very restricted entrance policy. And of course, today, of course, people can walk into yeshiva. There's always a yeshiva for somebody. But back in the beginning of the Chronim in Europe, what type of student was going to what type of yeshiva?
Okay. The earlier parts of the Achronic period, mostly it was small yeshivot in different towns, usually headed by the Rav or Dayan in that town. And he would draw, because of his name and so on, he would draw students usually from more or less that area, but sometimes he had enough of a name, he would also draw from further away.
And you're like your father sent you? It's like a shidduch, like you went where
sometimes
your father learned? Or where
it depends. That often depended. Sometimes it was your father, sometimes it was somebody who really had a thirst of his own and pushed for it. Sometimes it was the Rav that he learned with in his little town who felt that, I have a bright student here who can do well, and he knew of this yeshiva or that yeshiva he would send people to. Beginning with the Lashon, and then with, in that model, the Tells, the Nir, the Panovich yeshiva that developed, each with their own styles, there we started getting a more centralized yeshiva, larger, more centralized yeshiva. But even then, the smaller yeshivot continued to exist in different places. And in many cases, what would happen is students would first learn for a period of time in one of these smaller yeshivot, gain that skill and that ability in learning, and then to one of these more advanced yeshivot.
So what percentage already of people, a good learner?
Was that? One at a time. 1% at a time, I can't hear.
What percentage of people went to yeshivot? Oh, I was very, very small.
What percentage of the population? I don't know. I don't
it wasn't
know.
Like today.
I believe it wasn't very high.
It was not very high. It's only the brightest. The really
I think that today we have a far higher percent of people who are learning some period of time in yeshivot than ever existed in Europe.
And everyone who went was already a very good learner. It's not like they needed the Hebrew art scroll or signposts.
They didn't need it because they were trained from scratch in reading it. Now again, there were those who didn't have the ability, and there weren't, unfortunately, there weren't any kind of institutions that were able to serve those who were mediocre, right? Things like that. But the learning in itself was from scratch, to really learn the text, to know the language, to be able to deal with it. One of the faults today is the fact that in the United States, for example, they turned away from what used to be Ivrit v'Ivrit to teaching in English. So for example, my father, my father was the first to really start going to Chutz La'aretz to interview students and on the basis of acceptance when he was in Michlala. This was in the 70s, right? And the 80s, but it began in the 70s. He would give the girls a piece of Ramban la Torah to read, to learn, and answer questions about. Today, you could not do that with a boy who learns in a yeshiva.
Really?
He doesn't have the language skills to do that. He can talk about, you learn about a sukkah, he'll talk about all kinds of things, and you ask him to read the text, and he mumbles it away, he distorts everything. He says, my Rebbe said this, my Rebbe said that. Okay, the running away from the Greek being Greek, which was supposedly because the learning of the language is taking away so much time, I think undermined the true capabilities of learning. In Europe, that wasn't the case. And therefore, people as a whole now, their language of discussion was often in Yiddish. But they had the learning capacity in Hebrew. Most of the Achronic, maybe all, the Achronic works that we have are not written in languages, not even in Yiddish. They're written in Hebrew. You can discuss the quality of the Hebrew versus today's Hebrew, but it's written in Hebrew. That is part of the learning world. Therefore, they have those abilities. Any case, going back to this brisk issue, so, and then both through his children and some of his Talmidim, the approach of brisk learning is spread out to many different places. Just to mention some of the well-known personalities that learned with Chaim and took it is obviously his son, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev, the Griz, who becomes the head of the Brisk dynasties and all the Brisk yeshivot here in Yerushalayim. The Griz took over from Chaim as the Rav in Brisk, and later on came to live in Yerushalayim. The other son, Moshe Soloveitchik, who's less well known, and the only reason most of us know of Moshe Soloveitchik is because of his son, of Yosef Dovalevi Soloveitchik. But Moshe Soloveitchik, you see it through the Rav, and when you do find a little bit that Moshe wrote, you see the tremendous scholarship. Another important personality that affected a lot of the Brisk learning is Rav Baruch Ber Leibowitz, who wrote the Birkat Shmuel, the Talmud of Rav Chaim. Birkat Shmuel became a cornerstone of an achron to learn in analytical yeshivot. Another student of Rav Chaim, who then takes it, that's why I say sometimes these things are taken and will change, takes it in a very much different approach, is Rav Shimon Shkol. the also this chidushim are a center, definitely in the Haredi world, as far as learning and analytical learning. So Reb Chaim, in that sense, creates here a power that generates a very strong force of analytical learning that starts infiltrating into the world of Torah in the latter part of the Achronic period.
And again, touch upon like a Musa yeshiva and a Hasidic
Okay, and the purpose is not here so much to get to different yeshivot.
If you walked in, you could tell the difference.
Yes, you as a whole, in the overall carrying of things, you could probably tell if it's a Musa yeshiva or not. But there were also different levels. In other words, Slabatka was a Musa yeshiva in its full force, right? The opposite, Valazhin, right? When Reb Chaim Valazhin was asked about bringing in Musa learning into Valazhin, his answer was that Musa is a great medicine, but medicine is taken only by people who are sick. Our Talmidim are not ill. That was his answer, right? giving also a shtach to the. Was he right or not? That's the second question. That was an extreme on the other hand. Some of the other yeshivot had a certain amount of differing amounts of Musa learning that came in, but probably not at the same extent as Slavok. Okay, back to our discussion of Gemara commentaries in the Achronic period. We're almost finished with our time, but let me move from this general discussion of approaches, the pilpul, the bekiut, the analytical approach, to try to just bring some names to give a feeling of who is in what different parts and periods of the Achronic period. Some, I'm assuming that all of you will be familiar with the names. The Brisk, I mentioned the names already. Some of them you'll be more familiar with. Some of the people might be less. But I've chosen just several more known Achronic personalities that dealt with directly writing commentaries to the Talmud. Because in the same way that the Brisks created a situation where the Rambam became not just a halachic book, but a commentary to the, or used as a commentary to the Sugya, a lot of the halachic books that were written in the Achronic period have analysis of Sugya and have become in themselves a source of analytical discussion of Sugya, such as the Shach, the Sma, the Tivo, the Ktzot. We'll discuss them when we get to the halachic world. But in the commentary world, I'll begin with, I think, chronologically here, as far as those I wrote down for myself, the earliest is the Chochmat Shlomo, the Maharshal. Okay? The Chochmat Shlomo, written by the Maharshal, lived from the years 1510 to 1574. So you see, he's really the beginning of the Achronic period. As a matter of fact, we'll discuss that next time, he is one of the leading antagonists or people who object to the Shulchan Aruch. He was also very opposed to the pilpul approach. Even though the pilpul approach is only developing that, he sees what isn't he has a lot of objection to it. The Maharshal, Rabbi Shlomo ben Yechiel Luria.
We presume because it's after the printing press that everyone had like a Gemara to learn with. And
No. Even though the printing press allowed for a much broader dispersion and exposure to the things, no, not everyone had. Not everyone had for two reasons. A, at that time, printing was still much more limited because it was complex and what it was hard to print. B, it was expensive, and people in Europe just didn't have the money to buy what some average people might have in their library at home. Many people did not have, even if they were Torah scholars. So no, the answer is no. You know, when you see every time you see pictures of Rabbanim and so on sitting in their studies or something, you see this wall full of books that you have today. That did not exist for most people in Europe. Okay, so one of them is, so again, we have the Maharshal Shlomo ben Chia Luria from 1510-1574. Another one who today, his commentaries are usually printed together with the Chochmat Shlomo, is the Maharsha, the Shmuel Eliezer Berab Yehuda Halevi Edels. That's the Aleph in the end of the Maharsha. The interesting thing is that Edels is the name of his mother-in-law. Okay? He takes on the name of his mother-in-law, and that's the way he's referred to, because his mother-in-law supported him in learning for many years. And that respect comes across in the name, his full name. The Maharsha lived from 1555 to 1632. Okay? He writes chidushim, very sharp chidushim, that include comments on the Gemara and understandings of Rashi and Tosfot. There are people in certain circles who will say you can't learn and understand the Tosfot without the Rashi. On the other hand, there are those who say keep away from the Maharsha; he distorts the Tosfot. Okay, so we have two different worlds. The Maharsha was very sharp, very, very strong in his approaches. He opens certain doors, but yes, it sets certain questions in mind.
Doesn't he also write on the Agada?
Yeah. It's also Agada.
That's for his mother-in-law.
No, that's for him. Okay, let's take a third personality before we finish. The Pnei Yehoshua. Okay, Rabbi Yaakov Yehoshua Falk. He is already a little further into the Achronic period, and say more or less mid-Achronic period. He was born in 1680, he passed away in 1756. He has...
Who are we talking about?
The Pnei Yehoshua. A well-known book. The Pnei Yehoshua focuses a lot of his work on trying to explain Rashi's approach in light of questions that were raised, usually questions that were raised by the Baalei HaTosfot, the students of Rashi, but not only the Baalei HaTosfot, in understanding the sugya through the eyes of Rashi. But it's not absolutely that way. Pnei Yehoshua also writes his own analysis, his own understandings of the sugya, but yes, he puts in a lot of effort to justify and support the view of Rashi in understanding the Gemara.
Unlike the Gemara, do they start putting in punctuation?
No.
They don't?
No.
You know, why don't they do that?
I
found them very hard to read because of that.
Bruce, I would say two things. Number one, when you grow up and you're educated to read in a certain thing without that tool, you're able to do it more freely and fluently, and it disturbs you less. The other is simply technology. The adding in of punctuation was probably a significant effort and addition to add to the printing, therefore was not done. In the same way as the fonts that are used, to us drive us crazy. Right? A lot of people have a hard time learning Rashi in the Gemara because it's printed with the Rashi. It's what's called the Rashi print, right? The Rashi font. I'm assuming that the reason was that there was an interest to distinguish it from the Gemara itself and what they had, the abilities that they had. This is what it was. But it's challenging. It's difficult. Yes, there's a lot of difficulties that today we try to overcome, some for the better, some necessarily not always for the better. And you know what? Even the issue of the punctuation sometimes was significant. And when you put in punctuation today, what are you going to do when somebody tells you, but that's not the correct punctuation? Because you have a machloket amongst the commentaries, how to truly punctuate this.
So you argue about it.
Consistent. But you have to understand that when you add these things, in the same way as translation, by definition, has an aspect of commentary, putting in the punctuation, 90% of the time is not problematic. But that other 10% is an issue affecting the understanding and the commentary with its pluses.
I imagine if you have your with your chavruta without punctuation, the same argument exists every couple of lines. Is this a question?
It doesn't exist.
Where's the comma?
Because once you're familiar with the reading, it doesn't. There are kind of words and so on that give indication to what the issue is. But yes, it comes up, but it's part of the learning. It's part of the analysis, which is taken away when you put in the punctuation for better or for worse. Okay, I'm going to end here, not to hold you back from your next shiur. So next time we'll go through a few more of the important commentaries and then deal with the halachic world in the Achronic period.
So when you want to read something yourself quickly, in the sense that whether it's a regular Gemara or an art scroll Hebrew or it's Steinsaltz Hebrew, it just doesn't matter to you. Whatever the language is you're just...
I wouldn't say it doesn't matter to me, but as a whole, much more accustomed to reading a piece of Gemara, I will. Sometimes you do read it and you have to go back and you do question yourself, wait a minute, is this here or is this there? But that's part of the learning, because sometimes that can have a difference in meaning of what the Gemara is saying, since it was written with punctuation. To put in the punctuation is basically coming and deciding for somebody what it should be when that might not be the case.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Have a good day and a good week.
Shabbat Shalom. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was interesting. Thank you.